You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, November 7th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
We have not been all together recording a regular show in quite a while because of our big trip that we took.
Yeah.
I feel like I don't know what to do. Is this a podcast?
Yeah. What do I do with my hands? It's funny. One of the funniest moments on the trip was we were at QED, and one of our listeners, who was a little starstruck, came up to us, and she was taking a selfie with us, and she literally did, like, I don't know what to do with my hand. She was posing with the photo.
Talladega Nights, was that movie?
Yeah. Talladega Nights, yeah. That was arguably the best scene in the entire movie. Hey, speaking
awesome.
Of movies, I saw A Star Is Born.
Oh, I heard that was incredible.
The remake?
Yes, and it was one of the best movies I've seen in a very, very long time.
That's what I've heard from so many people. And Lady Gaga. But I heard that, like, Jay, did you cry?
I cried. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing is, I always talk about character development.
Yes,
you know, having the movie be about characters, because it doesn't really matter. The special effects and all that are fun and everything, but if you don't care about the characters, then nothing matters. This movie was actually just about characters. There was no special effects. Nothing exploded.
Nothing exploded.
They just had they have this remarkable relationship that they build in this film, and you know, all the things that go with it. And it was just a wonderful, beautiful, you know, very, very emotion-filled relationship, and you know, you see what happens to them, and I was riveted by this film. Like 15 seconds into it, it just grabbed me. And you know, it's a day and a half later, and I'm like listening to the soundtrack, which I usually never do, and I just thought the soundtrack was amazing. You know, this was really one of the best films I think I've ever seen.
Jesus.
I wish I'd seen it so I could join you in the conversation.
Well, you can still see it. I think it's in theater still.
Yeah, cool. You should go see it in the theater, guys.
Okay. So,
next topic.
Yeah, enough about Lady Gaga. Can I tell you guys what I did this weekend?
You saw Star Is Born?
What movie did you see?
No, guys, this weekend was SciComm Camp, and it was
right. How'd it go?
It was so great. So this is the fourth year that two of my friends, Jason Goldman, Sarah Curtis, and myself have put on. It's called SciComm Camp, which stands for Science Communication Camp. It's a sleepaway camp retreat, so it's sort of part conference, part, I don't even know what to call it. We tried to take all of the good parts of academic conferences, you know, like the parts where you're just in the coffee break meeting people and like talking to them about your work and like getting really good advice and stuff, and build an entire conference around that with a lot of cool downtime. It's very rustic and you bond a lot because it's like summer camp, except, you know, the rooms are really nice and the food's super good. And it was really fun. There was a handful of people there that heard about it because of the Skeptic's Guide, which was super cool. Also, the publisher was nice enough to donate copies of books for every single camper. So that was a really great surprise that I got to give everybody who was there. So if you didn't come, you missed out on your free book.
Ooh.
Maybe next year. It was so fun, you guys. I had a great time.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
I'd love to make it one year.
Yeah, we'd love to have you. It'd be awesome.
So cool.
Awesome.
So we do have a couple of things coming up that we'd like to talk about. So our next event is going to be Friday, November 30th. In Washington, D.C., we're going to have an evening program at the Smithsonian.
Mm.
So we will give you the link at smithsonianassociates.org. You can buy tickets at 6:45 p.m. in the evening.
Now, Steve, didn't they agree?
Yep.
Yeah,
did they agree that we could take a group shot with some listeners on a dinosaur's back? This is happening.
It's not that kind of museum.
No, because it has to be. Kara, you promised me dinosaurs, and I need dinosaurs.
You know what we can do? Is we can all meet beforehand or the next day at the Natural History Museum. Maybe we can do a meetup, and we can all take a picture with the dinosaur, which would be super cool. That would be really fun.
Saturday night, so this is now December 1st, we're going to be getting together with the National Capital Area Skeptics. The details of that to be determined, so stay tuned. And I believe that the Smithsonian is granting the Capital Area Skeptic members discount for the tickets for the Smithsonian event as well.
That's super cool.
Yeah. And one more thing before we start the show, very quickly. All right. Our year-end wrap-up episode is coming up. We'll be recording that on December 19th. So that means sometime before then, please send us your votes for episode of the year, best science news item of the year, all the usual stuff. Skeptical jackass of the year, skeptical hero of the year.
Your favorite segment.
Yeah, all those things. And then because we like to reminisce about a year in skepticism at the end of every calendar year. So we'll be recording that on December 19th.
Awesome.
All right. It's been a busy year, but we got a regular episode coming up. Kara, you're going to start us off with a what's the word?
Oh my gosh, you guys, it's been so long since we've done this.
I know.
Do you remember how to do it?
I think Kara might.
The word is your segment. You talk about these weird words that people
email
you in.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'm really glad I prepped one. So the word this week is agglutination, and this wasn't actually recommended by any of the listeners. It's something that I remembered being a great word, a great kind of vocab word that I would teach way back when I used to teach freshman biology lab. And it was so, so much fun. Agglutination, not fun.
Can I take a stab at it?
Yeah.
All right. This is when they spray gluten at people that think they have celiac disease, right?
That's so mean. It's like a quick and dirty test. No, that's not what it is. But, you know, good guess. People always tell me to spell the word. So agglutination, just so you know, it's agglutination. Agglutination. Two Gs. Okay, so agglutination has a biological definition. This is the one that I'm the most familiar with. It has to do with a serological response to an antibody. So this is blood stuff. So, for example, when red blood cells of a certain blood type interact with those of a non-compatible type, there are antibodies in one that interact with the antigens of another, and they cause this gloopy clumping reaction. That's agglutination. It's the clumping reaction. It's a specific type of clumping. It's not the same as clotting. So a lot of people might accidentally call it clotting because it looks like clotting, but agglutination is specifically this antibody antigen reaction. It's why you have to have a compatible blood type in a transfusion, because otherwise your blood will like turn into this thick, gloopy mass and you will die. It's very bad. Yeah. You will die unless there are some ways to kind of fight against it, but it's still super dangerous. So interestingly, agglutination, I didn't realize this until I looked it up, can also occur with erythrocytes. Those are red blood cells that come into contact with non-antibody substances like certain plant proteins, viruses, the salts of heavy metals, some colloidal acids and bases, and also some proteins, certain types of big proteins when they get in the blood, they can actually cause an agglutination response as well. But those things are obviously kind of rare and they'd be localized. The reason that agglutination from an infusion of the wrong blood type is dangerous is because it is infused, right? It goes through a lot of your blood before that response starts to gum it up. Okay, so a little more. Interestingly,
before you go on, Kara, yes. Do you know why antibodies cause agglutination?
Like, what do you mean, why?
How does it happen?
Well, the antibodies connect with the antigens and they stick together.
Yeah, but then why does that form a big clump? Why isn't just one antibody with one antigen? The reason is that the IgG antibodies are shaped like a Y and they have two binding sites.
So they stick to two different particles.
And so you can just make a chain that way. And so they all clump together.
Yeah, and it's super, like, gross. In the blood labs, we would use synthetic blood to show the difference. And, you know, we'd go through and calculate. That's why type O blood, or O negative, I should say, is a universal donor, because they don't have them on the surface so that nothing binds to them. Mm-hmm. That's why AB can be really dangerous. It could be the universal recipient, though, because they don't have the antibodies. So it's a really cool thing when you learn about this in lab, and then you get to actually use the synthetic bloods and the synthetic agglutinins and see, like, what happens to them. It's super gross looking. Okay, but one thing I realized when I was doing this research is that agglutination has a more general literary definition, or I should say grammatical definition, that I wasn't aware of, but it makes perfect sense. So, but it took a minute for me to really understand it. I'm going to give a super quick and dirty. It's the agglutination in grammar or in linguistics is the formation of derivational or inflectional words by putting together constituents of which each expresses a single definite meaning. Okay, don't know what that means at all, so I looked up all the component parts. So derivational morphemes are affixes, so or affixes. They're like prefixes or suffixes that can change a word from a noun to, let's say, an adjective. Like they actually change the word form, like or any other part of speech, really. So let's say we take beauty and we add a derivational morpheme and we turn it into beautiful. And those words mean two different things. Whereas inflectional morphemes are suffixes that change a word's tense, number, possession, comparison, but they don't change the meaning of the word. Like beauty becomes beauties. It means the same thing. Okay, so yeah. So those are the two words in that sentence that I didn't know what they meant. In agglutinative languages, derivational morphology is used a bunch. So it leads to these really big complex words that are strung together with oodles and oodles of morphemes. So
like German.
Yes. And like, I think they said Romanian and Hungarian maybe. So yeah, you have these words that have all these different like chunks added to it and it changes the meaning of the sentence. These massive compound words. But you're right. German's a great example of that. So that's kind of cool. Didn't know that. That's agglutinative language. Okay. So etymology of the word. Why would both of those definitions make sense? Because it's from the 1540s Latin root that means fasten with glue or stick on. So when the word first started being used in the English language, agglutination, in the 1540s, it meant act of uniting by glue.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like gluing a bunch of things together. And that's sort of what happens in your blood, except it's not actually glue. It's antibodies and antigens, but it looks like glue.
Elmer's and, antigens.
Yeah, exactly. And its use in language theory, or new word I found out, philology. Ooh, philology. It's a good one. Yeah. P-H-I-L-O-L-O-G. Sorry, P-H-I-L-O-L-O-G-Y, philology. So that's kind of like studying language through history and linguistics and different changes that occur in it. It's sort of like the study of how languages evolve and how languages are formed and stuff. In that sense, it didn't start until the mid-17th century. That's a really cool word. I knew what it meant, you know, that's why I recommended it. But then I had never really dug into it that deeply and I learned a bunch of new stuff. So thank you for letting me do that.
It is one of those words where you kind of know what it means when you hear it. Like, you know, it's like stuff clumping together.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. It does. It's like when you take the SATs or the GREs, how you can actually get a lot of the linguistic, or I should say is it called the English section? The verbal section, maybe? Like, there's a lot of really high-level words, and it's hard to memorize all of them, but there's so much context that you can use, and sometimes words just sound like what they mean.
Right.
And agglutination is a great example of that.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Jay, you're going to start us off with the news with an update on Oumuamua.
In October of 2017, going way back, something of great import took place. So Earth-based astronomers detected something never before seen by our species. Yep, I know you're intrigued. The first confirmed interstellar visitor to our solar system. It's that asteroid that Steve said. The
Oumuamua.
Oumuamua.
He's just not going to say it at all.
Oumuamua, I can speak Hawaiian very well, by the way.
Word, I like it.
For your, just for your edification, it means scout. Mm-hmm. And I think it's funny that they picked that because, you know, the undertone here is that this might be, you know, an alien type of thing, but let's get into it. So if you remember, the asteroid, you know, has the Hawaiian name because it was first detected by the Panoramic Survey Telescope and this Rapid Response System 1. It's called Pan-STARRS 1. That's based in Hawaii, so they use the Hawaiian word to name it. The astronomers are able to figure out that it was from outside of our solar system due to the fact that it's moving like incredibly fast, and it's got this pretty wonky trajectory that if we follow the trajectory, we could see where it came from and we could tell where it's going to go. So it's not a part of our solar system. And unfortunately, this thing can't get captured by our sun. It would have been cool if it got captured and we could study it for a long time. It's going to leave our solar system at one point. Actually, you know, a long time from now, but it's going to leave on its own power. And I'm sure that many of you have seen artist renderings of this asteroid.
On its own power, that doesn't mean it's propelling itself.
We don't know that, Bob. And I don't want you. And
yeah,
I don't,
Bob.
And I don't want you to worry because I'm going to tell you everything that humanity knows about this thing.
I think they stole it from Star Trek IV.
Yes. Oh my God, that, Evan, that. Totally. And that remember that stupid noise that thing was making?
The whale sounds out of water, yeah.
So it's kind of cigar-shaped, and another cool thing is that it happens to be tumbling end over end, and you can't tell that by just seeing a picture of it. You know, and this thing is, you know, it's pretty sizable.
That's so, why we need a GIF of it.
Exactly.
Or a GIF.
Or a GIF, yes. Thank
you. The reason why this particular asteroid is even more interesting to us mere mortals, that there is something odd about it. In June of this year, astronomers determined that there is, like, there's some force that's happening. There's an outside force that is not gravity of our, the gravity of our solar system, and not its inertia that it came into our solar system with. There is a force affecting it. Now, Bob.
Yeah.
I knew that you were going to get excited about this thing, like thinking it's under its own kind of power. But I don't think anybody reasonable actually thinks that it has an engine, even though, you know, there are scientists that think that this could possibly be some type of alien artifact, which does sound ridiculous. What they think is happening is that the object approaches the sun. And of course, as it gets closer to the sun, the object is becoming more and more heated. And the idea is that if there's any volatile gases that exist on the asteroid, these would kind of act like a rocket engine. You know, you could just think of like, you know, some type of liquid, say, a collection of liquid, say, is underneath the surface, and it heats up and it kind of shoots out when it gets to a certain temperature. And that could push this asteroid in a direction that would make its trajectory a little strange.
Does that happen with comets?
Yes.
Now, comets, yeah. Now, the tail of a comet is that actual – is the off-gassing.
Is it propulsion?
Yes.
It becomes propulsion. Okay.
Interesting. That's
yeah, but
cool.
It's not necessarily but the tail is not moving away from the direction of
no,
movement.
It's moving in the direction of the solar wind.
Right.
But that is providing a force, a propulsive force to the comet. So
yeah, it's a little tiny.
Jay, let me throw in a couple of details. So first of all, you realize we didn't discover this until after it had already passed its closest approach to the sun. So we saw it on its way out.
Yeah. Yep.
And so at that point, it should be decelerating, right? It speeds up as it approaches the sun, and then after it passes the sun, the sun's gravity should be slowing it down a little bit.
Yeah.
The problem was it wasn't slowing down. So there was something giving it a propulsive force that was maintaining its velocity.
And there's really only so many things that it could be, if you think about it. Like, what could it possibly be? And the list is very short. So when they looked at it, they said, well, maybe we misclassified it. Is it an asteroid or is it actually a comet? Because a comet has off-gassing, and that would make sense. And then they said, well, maybe it's in the gray zone in between an asteroid and a comet. Maybe it's an asteroid that just has a little bit of, you know, ice on it or something that could boil and shoot away. Or it could be a comet that's at the end of its life and it already off-gassed all of the gas that could come off of it. So it really isn't – right now we can't with any certainty say exactly what it is. And I think, you know, they're going to have to study this thing a lot more to get down to the details. But now there's a couple of cool things going on here. First, I named it. It's a Comaroid.
You named it, huh?
Yes. Comaroid. We should just call it a Comaroid because it's in the gray zone.
Okay, I'm going to add that to the list of made-up words right now.
That's a long list.
We're on number 26.
Well, sound a little bit like hemorrhoid, but
yeah. So does asteroid. Anything with
roid at the end. Asteroid gray zone object. Got it.
So this news item has now taken on the allure of a movie. So you would think, because a major plot line is about to wrap up, right? But there is a breaking twist at the very end here. So there's two scientists, Shmuel Bailey and Professor Abraham Loeb, did not fully agree with the outgassing idea to explain the asteroid's trajectory. These two scientists have introduced another possible hypothesis. They're calling it the solar sail effect. And this is really cool. To explain this, now imagine that the sunlight that hits the asteroid's surface actually slightly pushes it, right? Because there is that effect is provable, and we can observe that effect. Now, this would require the object to be incredibly thin, a fraction of a millimeter thin to be accurate, and it would have to be big enough in size to absorb enough of the solar radiation to actually nudge this thing. They also note in their paper that the object could either be naturally occurring or, here we go, of alien design. They're not throwing that idea out. Now, I think most people, if not virtually everyone, is leaning towards the fact that it's naturally occurring. So they point out that the changes of the object, like, you know, this coming into our solar system and the fact that it's so close to our planet, like it's a 1 in 100 million chance that this thing would come anywhere near Earth. That's like winning the lottery, or even better than winning the lottery.
That's the thing that I found most interesting about the paper. I mean, yeah, saying, oh, it could be an alien artifact, as we've pointed out, right? They say that about every unknown astronomical phenomenon. It could be alien, and it never is, at least so far. And, you know, saying that this is a solar sail rather than just a little bit of outgassing. Yeah, they point to some anomaly, but I don't know how, like, its spin should have been evolving in a certain way. I don't know that we have enough observations to say that. Most astronomers still think, yeah, it's just a cometoid, as Jay says.
Yeah.
But the other argument they make, they say this object came within 0.25 AU of the sun and 0.15 AU of the Earth. The probability of that happening is so small that in order to have a reasonable chance of that happening, then solar systems should eject objects like this at about 10 to the 15 such objects over their lifetime, right?
That's a lot of objects.
Yep.
Which is 100 million times more than we think is happening, right?
100 million times more. That is such a profoundly huge number.
Yeah, so another way of looking at that is to say that this was a 1 in 100 million chance. If these asteroids are ejected at the rate we think they are, the probability of one coming that close to the Earth is 1 in 100 million.
Yes. So that's that's pretty profound. Now, I think now that we're aware of it, you know, maybe, you know, of course, all these things cost money and time, but hopefully we'll be able to find more of these. And I hope that we can continue to study this object as well. You know, I know that it's getting farther away from us, but, you know, you never know. We might be able to really figure out or narrow down the possibilities of what's actually going on here. Now, something to give you a little perspective. In 3 years, the object is going to cross Neptune's orbit. So it's not moving as fast as you think. And it'll take 11,000 years for it to get 1 light year away, which, you know, again, like I thought it was moving a lot faster from articles I was reading, but it's not moving at insane speeds. But
well, that's really fast. It's just that space is really big.
Yeah. So this isn't going to back, you know, this isn't going back to any alien planet soon unless it has a hyperdrive or it's using some type of subspace communications to send back the information. Well, you know, Bob, if it's spying on us, it's got to relay that information back to the mother planet, right? Yeah.
You would think.
So that's the idea, is that it's a probe, right? That it was deliberately aimed at the Earth.
Yeah.
They missed.
You know, that's the argument. Well, yeah. I mean, it was a flyby, right? It was a probe that was designed to be a flyby.
Oh, it was designed to be 10 million miles away from the Earth.
Now, how about guys, like in a couple of weeks, we get up in the morning and the breaking news is that this object just stopped dead in space.
Oh,
yeah. Wouldn't that make everybody lose it? Oh, my God.
Or it's gone.
Yeah.
Like it warped away.
or more probable that we detect a signal coming from it like 2001, you know?
Yep.
Ooh.
Oh, man.
Because they looked and it's not emitting any radio waves. But again, you know, if it were an alien artifact, what, you know, could be using something else to communicate. But imagine if it gives off a burst of radiation aimed at some star. That would be interesting. That would be really interesting.
How would we detect that then?
Well, because we're close enough to get some blowback.
We would have to develop nanotechnology as quickly as possible.
I don't know how that's related, but okay. Yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, obviously, this is like wild speculation, and it's the thing is an asteroid. It's tumbling end over end. You know, it's just a little bit of outgassing will explain its acceleration.
It's fun,
and
is what it is.
I think, yeah, but it's fun to think of. I mean, this is what I think the authors are doing. And the probability thing, it's a legitimate mystery, you know. So what these things turn out to be when we think, is it little green men? It turns out to be something new about the universe that we didn't know.
Yeah.
So it's always good astronomy. What's probably going to happen is that we will see more of these objects and we'll realize that they are being produced at a much higher rate than we thought. You know, they are being flung out of their systems at very, very high rates. But even still, it may also be that this was just a really low probability event, you know? I mean, it's interesting to think about that. Like, if astronomers see something super low probability, like we do win the cosmic lottery, that would screw up our science because you know, we would never account for such a low probability event occurring. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's yes. all to me. It's all just fascinating. You know, this is. I mean, wouldn't we love to know what that thing is made out of? Right? Imagine getting a ship on there and just scraping that and pulling, bringing some back. Oh man!
Right? I mean, yeah, you could tell us about the kind, because you know, the isotopes and the metallicity, all that kind of stuff changes based upon where you are in the galaxy, where you are in the solar system. If we could get our hands on an interstellar object, that would be the first time we could actually measure like how much metallicity is coming from deeper within the galaxy or whatever. That would have been amazing science, but it's just going too fast for us to send anything to catch up with it. Yeah. At least, but it's also, how about this? It's interesting to think that maybe in 100 years or 200 years, we'll be able to catch up with it. It'll be a lot farther away, but we'll have a lot better ships. You know, we might be able to send a probe to catch up with it in 100 years or 200 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's true, Steve. I didn't even think about that. I know our technology could advance and then we can get that sucker.
So, hey, do you guys know that I am a mild protan?
Yes. Butan, propan, whatever you got.
Yes. Colorblindness, right?
Spicy
yes.
protan.
Yes. Colorblindness. Yeah. Protan, yeah. Protan is red, green.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happens is the, because you know, you have three cones where most humans are trichromatic, although there's occasional, what do you call it, the four one?
Because there's red, green, blue, and yellow. And
birds have five cones?
No, four.
Oh, they have four.
We have three. Most primates have two, but we picked up a third one. But in any case, if the wavelengths of the red and the green one overlap a little bit, that means they kind of respond to some of the same frequencies of light, and then your brain can't really tell them apart because they're sort of activating two different cones, right? So then colors don't separate as well.
I know an exorcist who can beat that problem out of you, Steve. So
yeah.
You need help.
Well, there is a company that makes a product called the Enchroma glasses.
I've seen those.
They claim that if somebody who's colorblind wears these glasses, they could see more vibrant colors. They could see like somebody who isn't colorblind.
So did you buy these?
No. Because they're a little expensive. But there was a study looking at whether or not they actually work, which is the first study that I've seen. Now, I remember seeing these like a year ago or so. I'm like, I don't know about that. But I would have liked to test them, but, you know, it was like a couple $100 or something for the glasses, so I wasn't going to do that. So it was interesting because the company kind of backed off its claims over time, very similar to the way like supplement companies do. They kind of water down their claims to make sure they're saying that they're not curing or treating anything. It supports color vision, you know, just that.
Yeah.
Or here we go. Enchroma color blindness glasses have a profound impact on how people see their world.
Yeah, profound impact. That could mean anything.
Right. Yeah. So like I said, yes, so do sunglasses. You know,
that's true.
So do the palms of my hands over my eyes.
Yeah, so it's like a non-claim that's in, like these color blindness glasses affect how you see the world. It's an implied claim without actually making one, right?
Yeah.
So that's always a huge red flag. All right, and so how does it work? That's always when I look at these kind of medical claim supplement type, you know, snake oil websites. It's like I always like to go to the web page that's like scientific evidence or how does it work?
Yeah.
So this is what they say. To compensate for the overlap, remember the overlap that I just described, the Enchroma lens contains proprietary optical materials that selectively remove particular wavelengths of light exactly where the overlap is occurring. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So it's filtering out certain wavelengths of light, which is how I figured they worked, right? Because they're glasses. What theoretically could they be doing, right? They can't change the way your eyes are perceiving light or how your brain's processing light. They can't be adding things, right?
Right.
They're just filtering out certain frequencies.
So all you can do is filter. Yep.
That's what they say they do, but they claim that by filtering out the frequencies that are hitting the overlap, it helps separate the colors. But still, I'm not convinced because it's just taking away information. I'm not sure how that would improve or increase the number of colors that you could see or your color vision. So
how does it target the overlap only?
Well, that's another good question, right? I mean, you would need them sort of made specifically for you.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, this was a the scientists have done a study. It's a small study that they looked at 48 people with colorblindness and compared them to 200 normal volunteers or healthy volunteers. And they had them use the glasses and see first to just subjectively describe how do things look. You know, do you think things look better or they don't look better? And then they also had – they did standardized tests of colorblindness, the Ishihara test and the Farnsworth-Munsell test. Now, you guys have all had these. This is the
dots?
Color dots of light with a number in the circle, and then you have to read the number. Right.
I own those. I'm so good at them.
Yeah, I'm terrible at those. There's always circles that I can't see the numbers. Like most of them I can, and there's like the ones that everyone's like, yeah, there's a 23 in there. I can't see anything.
Yeah, this is like that scene. Do you guys remember that scene in Little Miss Sunshine? Have you guys seen that
yeah,
movie?
That was a cute
where
movie.
He finds out. Yeah. And it's really sad.
Steve didn't see it either, though.
He wants to be a fighter pilot. Oh, that's funny, Evan. Sorry.
Steve, do you notice it in your day-to-day life? Does weird things happen?
No, I would. All right, so essentially, if it weren't for those tests, the numbers in the circles,
you wouldn't even know.
I would not even know it, except occasionally, I perceive colors different than what other people do in a couple of ways. So there's like two other ways. So one, I will see certain like greens as blue or blue as green or like a blue is a gray sometimes. Mm-hmm. Like there are certain colors where to me they just are different, or like a purple is a pink or whatever. Like they're just, I disagree with other people about what color something is. And the other thing is there are certain color combinations that are very disturbing.
Oh, like they clash in your brain?
Yeah, they clash in my brain. They're like a scintillate or something. So the best example is the colors of the Miami Dolphin uniforms. Orange and aqua.
Yeah.
Like I might say it's orange and green, and other people are like, what are you talking about? It's not green, but
yeah, it's
yeah, but it's aqua, so it's kind of like half and half. But in any case, I see it more as green. But that kind of combat sort of orange on light green combination hurts my brain. I don't like looking at that. That's it. That's really the only, you know, those are the only things. That it really does not impact my day-to-day life, and I could probably never know about it if it weren't for the colorblindness tests themselves. Unless
Steve.
So, but what about traffic lights? Like, I've always wondered about that.
I'm mild. So people who are more severe, a severe protan, like, they can't tell. They cannot tell red from green.
So why did we pick red and green? Like, it just seems like the worst two colors to put on something that could be the difference between life and death.
So a friend of mine, you guys know Harry, he's a severe protan. And he cannot see the difference between the red and the green traffic lights. He has to go by their position.
But sometimes they're sideways.
But he learned about it when he was a kid. He would paint. He would color things wrong. Like he would color the leaves brown and the trunk green when he was doing coloring in a tree. Because he couldn't tell the difference, you know, between them.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
Steve, if I wore the color of those inner dots around you, would I be invisible?
It would be very slimming. All right. So the results of the test, what they found was that most of the people said it did not improve their vision. Only one of the 48 people thought things looked a little bit better. But in terms of the standard tests, the Ishihara and the Farnsworth-Munsell test, the color dot test, they didn't do better. They just did different, meaning that they were able to separate some colors better, but at the expense of other colors.
Yeah, it was a trade-off.
It was a trade-off. It was a complete lateral trade-off. It wasn't actually an improvement, which makes perfect sense. So they likened these glasses to – there are already glasses that have that effect that are for specific purposes. So like hunters, any of you guys go hunting? There are special hunting glasses that help you separate animals from the foliage. So, they help basically undo camouflage so that animals are easier to see in a forest setting. So they don't improve your vision, they just change it so that certain colors are easy to separate, but at the expense of other colors. But that is helpful if you're hunting animals in the forest.
Knocked right through that evolutionary advantage.
Yeah,
totally. It like gives things like a hyperpigmentation. Like green is so green that it's like so easy to see something brown against it.
So essentially, this company is just repurposing hunter glasses and claiming it's a treatment for color blindness.
Yeah, although but they can charge triple for it.
Yeah, that's what they do. But they're only pseudo claiming that, right? They backed off to this non-claim claim. So that all makes sense to me. You know that this like they didn't invent some new technology. It's the same shit that we already were doing, and it's just sort of a lateral trade-off. And then, you know, if you put people in a certain situation and put the glasses on them, then in that situation, like if you surround them with the correct colors, then they may pop more. So it's like you could kind of cheat really easily with that, and then you get then you write down the testimonial. Oh my god, I'm seeing all these colors, right? They do the non-claim followed by testimonials. But no real evidence in this proprietary technology, which they kind of describe in vague terms. But it turns out it's just old shit and nothing new. And it's just a lateral trade-off.
Yeah. Well, maybe they should rebrand it and find like specific scenarios where this is good. And like,
that's exactly right.
They could be truthful. Yeah. You know, not just hunting. There might be certain
traffic glasses, driving glasses. Yeah,
driving.
Or
yeah.
Well,
yeah,
maybe not driving.
Well, you could see the traffic lights.
Yeah, it's like blue blockers.
Yeah, that would be that'd be true. But for like night driving, I'm not sure glasses really help because you don't want any glasses you put on generally, like those ones that you that claim to enhance night driving. Don't think they work very
well.
They're filtering, they're darkening. They're actually taking away some light. Contrast might be better.
Yeah, it's the problem, at least for me, for night driving is that like my glasses help so much at night. Obviously, I shouldn't drive without them anyway, but I absolutely require them at night because they fix my astigmatism. Mm-hmm. And my astigmatism is part of the reason why night driving hurts because all the lights blur across my field of vision and they're like really distracting. But if I can turn those into pinhole lights, then I can see again. It's very hard for me to drive against headlight traffic. Do you guys have the same problem?
It's not particularly. Not really. No. But there's also polarization, which is another way to affect incoming light.
Yeah, that helps. You know? Sure.
Yeah, that helps because of the orientation of light that's reflecting off of things.
All my sunglasses are polarized.
Yeah, that's your basic sunglass technology. Yeah. Yeah, it's all good.
All good.
It's all
miracle
good.
Cure. Yeah. Oh, can't say that.
All right, Bob, I want my anti-gravity flying car. When am I going to get it?
Christmas.
Yeah, this was interesting and fun, and it's kind of similar to Jay's news item. See if you could figure out how. It should be pretty easy. But CERN will be conducting some interesting and unprecedented experiments with antimatter over the next 2 or 3 years to finally show one way or another if anti-atoms fall down or fall up in a gravitational field. Now, don't get your hopes up. Falling up is very unlikely. But if it happens, we're talking major scientific revolution, allowing potentially for a host of seemingly impossible sci-fi technology like gravity generators and warp engines. And of course, that's what really caught my attention. So yeah, this is one of those scenarios that's very low probability, but it makes the sci-fi geek in me squeal like Jay looking at a plate of endless meatballs.
That's true.
So we need to start with antimatter, though. We've talked about it a bunch of times on the show. It's antimatter is mostly matter, mostly. Same mass, same magnetic properties, same binding abilities, but they have the opposite electrical charge and spin. And we all know what famously happens when matter and antimatter meet, right? They annihilate each other in spectacular fashion. A lot of people know about that. But almost all of these similarities and differences that exist between matter and antimatter, they've been confirmed. We know for sure. They've done experiments after experiments, and they're solid, and we're very, very sure. But one major difference that has not been thoroughly tested was how does antimatter behave in a gravitational field? Does it accelerate on Earth like normal matter at 9.8 meters per second per second? It probably does, and they'll probably find out that it does, and that'll be it. But there's a chance it might not. We don't know. It's never been tested, and antimatter is a little squirrely. There's still some mysteries about it. So the European Organization for Nuclear Research, or CERN, is going to test this, and not just by creating antimatter, but something you may not have heard much about, anti-atoms. Now, people know that they've created antimatter for years, positrons, antiprotons, but they've actually become very, very adept at putting those components together to create entire antiatoms. So they can take antiprotons and bind them to antielectrons, otherwise known as positrons, to create neutral anti-hydrogen atoms. And that's really cool. They've got experiments now. They've got setups that can create thousands of these anti-atoms all at once, very quickly, very efficiently, relatively speaking. What they'll do is that they'll hold these anti-atoms in a magnetic trap and then turn it off, deactivate it, and see what effect gravity has on it. So that's a very simple explanation for what they're going to do, but it's a very complex process, as you can imagine. Amazing technology. I'll reiterate, theorists overwhelmingly believe it will accelerate down, like, towards the center of the Earth, like regular matter. That's probably what's going to happen. But what's so captivating is that, what if it doesn't? And the ramifications of that, that very fun question. What if it doesn't? It's an amazing question. Maybe it'll stay put. I mean, maybe it won't, maybe it'll just ignore gravity. Maybe it will fall normally 9.8 meters per second squared, but upwards in the opposite direction than you think. So the question is then, what does falling up mean in this context? What does that even mean? How could that even happen? So you have to think of it like this. That means that from gravity's perspective, antimatter has anti-mass. It has negative mass. So more accurately, a more accurate way to say that is negative gravitational mass energy. So that's how gravity would be looking at this. Now negative mass probably doesn't exist. We've never seen it, but we can think about it and think about what would happen if it really did exist. So that would mean that gravity, imagine gravity, we know that it's a unique force. It's so different than all the other forces. It's incredibly weak, amazingly weak, the weakest by far. It's so weak that it's so weak that we're like trying to figure out, why is it so weak? Maybe people have theorized that, oh, maybe some of the power, the energy is leaking into other dimensions. It's like, why is it so weak? We're not sure, but we do know that it's additive. Gravity is different from other forces like the electrical force. It's additive. Cause there's only one charge. There's not multiple charges of gravity. So it just adds up and adds up and adds up. And therefore the structure of the entire universe is because of gravity, purely gravity, and not the other forces that are far, far, far stronger. So if this thing falls up and anti-mass, this negative gravitational mass energy, if it does exist, then that means that gravity would actually have two charges, a positive mass and a negative mass, behaving in many ways like the positive and negative electric charges. So that's what could be so amazingly revolutionary. Now, if that happens, we're not talking just a Nobel Prize time, probably multiple Nobel Prizes. It'd be the science story of the century, probably. If it's not immediately recognized as such, I think looking back, it certainly would be. And we're talking both from a theoretical and an applications perspective. Now, theoretically, it would be unprecedented. This would certainly open up a rich vein of theoretical possibilities to explore. Finally, we would have some new amazing physics beyond the standard model. Technologically, though, we would see some crazy shit. It would be amazing. Now, imagine two gravitational charges means that we could make use of a panoply of sci-fi concepts that we look at today in movies and say, yeah, that's cool, but that's impossible. But with this, if this really happened, if anti-atoms fall up, this stuff isn't necessarily impossible anymore. For example, we could create gravitational conductors to shield yourself from the gravitational force. Imagine that. You put a gravitational conductor under you and then you don't feel gravity anymore.
Anti-gravity, it's like
Bob. Well, yeah, that's another way to say it, Jay. Anti-gravity. So gravitational capacitors could be set up to create artificial gravitational fields that you see on almost every fictional spaceship in every movie or book everywhere. Almost all of them invariably have some sort of artificial gravity because it just makes it easier. You don't want to have to necessarily deal with microgravity or zero gravity on these ships. So we got artificial gravity, but we could actually potentially even make it if this is true, if this happens. And warp drives could probably be created, allowing us to relatively easily deform space-time and not needing Jupiter-sized masses to actually deform space-time in any meaningful way.
What are the chances this will happen?
Yeah, don't get your hopes up. Back to reality. This is very unlikely. No theorist is betting on it, and you shouldn't bet on it either. But at this point, it's fun because at this point, you can't really say it's impossible, like perpetual motion is impossible, because right. That's really impossible.
That violates
this is only
laws.
Yeah, this is only a little bit impossible, and it's fun to think about it.
Totally
and,
a little impossible?
It's probably not. Yeah, now, a little impossible is not a great way to describe it. It's so unlikely. But hey, I'm just dying for some little crack in physics that points to some new stuff beyond the standard model. I'll take anything, and this would be sweet. So I'll end with a famous Spock quote that I'm sure all you Trek geeks would recognize. He said, "If I let go of a hammer on a planet that has positive gravity, I need not see it fall to know that it has in fact fallen."
Yeah.
That's from the which episode?
Oh,
which episode?
It's the trial. Demon? He's on trial or something.
Court Martial, the episode called Court Martial.
Yep. Court Martial. Yes, thank you.
If these experiments show what I would love for them to show, Spock's quote would hopefully be amended. He would say, "If I let go of an antimatter hammer on a planet, I need not see it fall to know that it has in fact fallen up."
Fall up.
But it does explain why he bothered to say positive gravity.
Well, that's kind of cool. I always thought, why even say that?
Apparently there is.
Oh,
but if you're on a planet, the implication is that there's
gravity.
It's regular old gravity. But so there you go. Look forward to those experiments in the next couple of years, and I'll keep my fingers crossed. But oh man, it would just be so sweet. Can you imagine? Yes, we can now make a gravity shields if we want. I mean, it would be feasible, but it's not going to happen, so don't worry about it. Probably. Most likely. Overwhelmingly likely.
Bob likes to talk about news items that aren't going to happen.
Well, it is fun to speculate,
aren't.
You know, it's possible. Yeah, aren't. Possible.
It always works within the boundaries of the laws.
I tell you, it's more likely that happens than that Onumahu Wahuhua is a spaceship.
Oumuamua. Okay. All right, that's true. We could say what are the probability of anti-gravity and the probability that Oumuamua is an alien space probe are about the same.
No, I go. My stuff's more likely than spaceship.
For all intents and purposes, the same.
Evan, so the Kepler telescope has been kicking ass for quite some time.
Yeah.
But
10 years.
But its time is now due.
Well, we knew this day had to come, and NASA had warned us earlier this year it was coming, but it was officially announced October 30th that the Kepler Space Telescope is retired, out of service.
That sucks.
Its 3-gallon gas tank ran dry.
It's out of gas. The thing is out of gas.
It ran out of gas. 3 gallons of hydrazine, gone. Took about 9 years for it to occur, so, which is longer than they thought. They could squeeze out of it. So that's
so you can't
that's
just always, pull up to a to the pump and fill it
no,
up.
No, no,
not they, yet.
I tell you, they should have powered it with something else, I suppose. But
unobtainium or something.
How come we can't refill it?
Because it's out there.
It's in space.
It's in deep space.
Bring it back. Well, it's in an orbit with Earth, but it's
bring
behind.
It back.
It's behind us. All we have to do is slow the Earth down. It'll catch up to us eventually. Then we can refuel
the
it.
The money it would cost to refuel it, just build another damn one.
But they got other projects in the works.
Yeah, so it's like an iPhone. The battery goes dead, you just get a new one. You don't replace the battery.
Yeah, but this space iPhone lasted 9 years. I mean, get that out of your iPhone 7 or whatever the hell it was. Now, you know it's a sad day when the first line of the Wikipedia entry for Kepler reads like this. Kepler is a retired space observatory launched by NASA. Isn't that sad?
So sad.
So sad.
So sad.
Launched by NASA to discover Earth-sized planets orbiting other stars. And yes, it was. And yes, it did. It did a fine job of that. And then some.
It's funny to think that Kepler's lifespan is entirely contained within the SGU's span.
Yes, that's
weird.
Right. It launched up on 2009.
Yeah, year 4.
Here was part of the original mission statement. The Kepler mission is specifically designed to survey our region of the Milky Way galaxy to discover hundreds of Earth-sized and smaller planets in or near the habitable zone and determine the fraction of the hundreds of billions of stars in our galaxy that might have such planets. And the results were better than expected. I mean, they did find plenty of Earth-sized planets, some of them rocky Earth-sized planets, about 36 or so. But they also found larger planets, all the way up to the size of Neptune. They found, as I'll borrow Bob's word, a panoply of planets.
Thank you.
All right. All exoplanets credited to Kepler, 3,826 of them. How many of those were discovered by the transiting method? Of the 3,800, roughly, how many of those were discovered by the transiting method?
I thought it was most.
It was most.
I thought so, too. Yeah.
Yeah. Just over 3,000 of them. Yeah. And that's what it was designed to do.
Yeah.
It actually has some additional candidates that have not been confirmed yet. And if the candidates come to be confirmed, that could raise its number to 4,700, 4,770. So more science still to be done on the data that Kepler actually collected. So the mission ran into some problems back in, when was that, 2013, when a couple of the gyros on the telescope stopped functioning. It had four of them. It could operate with three, but two of them, the second one went kaput in 2013. So they created a second mission. I don't know if it was a backup mission or it was planned that they were going to be doing this if, in fact, the gyros went out. And they called it the K2 mission, in which they sort of used it differently, in a sense. So instead of being able to point and have full control of where the telescope is pointed, they would leave it in a certain position for a certain amount of time and grab as much data as they could. And then the mission would essentially use the sun's solar wind to stabilize the telescope's pointing for several months at a time. Then about four times a year, the telescope would move to a different field of view if the sun would get too close to its sensors. So it kind of became two parts of the same mission. But it's continued to collect a lot of data. It didn't just use the transiting method. What they did in 2014 is they used a new technique called verification by multiplicity, which works in multi-planet systems. A star with multiple planets around it is gravitationally stable. So according to the theory, while a star that is part of a close-knit system of stars would have a more unstable system because each star would have this massive gravity. So you would have stability in the star you were observing. You can assume that there were planets around it, but the stars that didn't have planets on it were more unstable. And they were able to use this and essentially proof of concept using Kepler to do it. And through that technique, they confirmed an additional 715 planets using that method. So you got two different kinds of detection method out of one telescope, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it really was a workhorse of the exoplanet mission.
Kick butt.
Definitely.
You know, I'm impressed with how well NASA builds their machines. I mean, look at the rovers on Mars. I mean, talk about getting a bang for the buck, man. Wow.
Yeah, it had an initial price tag of $600 million for the mission. I mean, which is nothing, effectively. Now, they had to pour more money into it as it continued. But bang for your buck and return on investment, this was a big win. Big win for science.
And now we got the James Webb telescope coming up.
I am so excited about that. This could be,
it's a 6.5-meter primary mirror.
Okay.
James Webb, 6.5-meter. It's huge.
It's going to give us sharper images and deeper images.
It's 2.4 meters, Hubble.
2.4, yeah.
Thank you. So it's four times bigger.
There you go. That's what I said. Yeah. Four times bigger.
Around there. A little less than four
close
times
Close enough.
Bigger.
It's bigger. All right.
Bigger. It's bigger.
Wait, how'd you get four? It's 2.4 versus 6.5.
That's three.
Not quite.
A little less than three.
We should not talk about this anymore. The number keeps going down.
And according to NASA, scheduled for launch in 2021.
That's right.
It seems so far away, but...
Oh, I know, 2021.
I think they pushed that date, too.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, I'm sure they have pushed it at least a few times. But you got one shot to get this right. There's no correction. You can't send a space shuttle up to James Webb to fix it.
Think about the times we serviced Hubble. We can't do that.
Yeah.
No servicing.
This is a one-time and go.
Yeah.
One and done.
No spherical aberrations.
Have to get it right. Yeah, no kidding.
All right, we'll miss you, Kepler.
We'll miss you, Kepler. But it'll be in orbit, in the same orbit as the Earth around the Sun, just behind us.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. It's not going to decay because it's a deep space orbit. Yeah, and that's what Webb is going to be too. Webb's going to be at one of the Lagrangian points. Kara.
Yes.
So I'm hearing a lot of whining about the FDA's newly approved opioid.
Oh, Well, that didn't frame how you feel about the issue at all.
Just saying.
I'm definitely going to be interested in your take on this because I have tried to read coverage from a lot of different sort of neutral outlets to figure out what people are thinking about it. And yeah, some of this, I don't know, these thoughts, these feelings, these concerns are sort of on quote unquote both sides. So a little background. First approved November 2nd, 2018 is a drug named Dysuvia. This was first FDA approved on November 2nd, 2018, just a few days ago as of this recording. Dysuvia is sufentanil, which we already have sufentanil. The difference is that Dysuvia is a sublingual tablet for sufentanil. Sufentanil historically has only been able to be administered intravenously. This is a synthetic opioid analgesic formulation. I'm reading this directly off of the packaging. I don't have a package, but what it says on the package. It's a synthetic opioid analgesic formulation for the management of acute pain that is severe enough to require an opioid analgesic and for which alternative treatments are inadequate. Because of the potential for life-threatening respiratory depression due to accidental exposure, Dysuvia is available only through a restricted program called the Dysuvia REMS program, R-E-M-S. Dysuvia should only be administered by a healthcare provider in a certified, medically supervised healthcare setting. That really encompasses this conversation. There was a big press release from the FDA commissioner, Scott Gottlieb, that came out on November 2nd when Dysuvia was officially approved. You can read it in full. It's a very long statement trying to answer a lot of the concerns that people have voiced since this drug became marketable and since people started to realize that this was probably going to potentially become approved by the FDA. So here are the big concerns. We already have sufentanil on the market. Sufentanil is, of course, though, already available only through intravenous administration. So the argument here is that there are situations in which a patient might need immediate reduction of acute pain through something very, very strong. And when I say strong, how are they usually wording it in these articles? Sufentanil is 10 times more powerful than fentanyl. And it is, I think, what is it, 1,000 times or is it 100 times? Steve, do you remember? More powerful
thousand,
than
thousand
a thousand times.
More
times
more,
yeah.
More potent. More powerful than more potent is the better word.
You're right.
There.
That's a little more accurate. 1,000 times more potent than morphine, 10 times more potent than fentanyl. That doesn't mean necessarily that if you take the same amount, you'll be 1,000 times more like effed up. What it really means is that it takes much, much less of the drug to have the same effect. So obviously the potential for abuse of something like this is potentially enormous if it's not well regulated. So popular science gives a little bit of background on the opioid quote unquote epidemic. From 1999 to 2016, over 630,000 people in the US have died from a drug overdose, and over half of those, so more than 315,000 of those within that time span, directly involved opioid medication. That's according to the CDC. On average, when calculated, about 115 Americans die every day from an opioid overdose. So keep that in mind. Now, many of these people have prescription opioid drugs available to them. Many of these people are using opioids that they've purchased on the street. Sufentanil can be abused on the street, and it is actively. Like, there are many cases of people overdosing on sufentanil. This new drug, again called Dysuvia, which is the sublingual form of sufentanil, is a single tablet. And the way that tablet is administered is through a single-use package. So it almost looks like a little needle, but instead of a needle, it's like a push administrating piece of plastic that pops the little tablet underneath a person's tongue, and the entire package is only loaded with one tablet. And so the idea here is that should reduce the ability for abuse because you're not buying a bottle of pills at a time. You get a single dose in your administration. And we're not talking a prescription that you can buy at a commercial pharmacy. This is something that's only on hand in hospitals, for example. And the biggest argument, the biggest conversation I've read over and over is that this is this was meant to be used and was heavily advocated for by the Department of Defense. So this is meant to be used in battleground situations as well. So you imagine a soldier who has a terrible injury and it's not feasible to have IV opioids available. Instead of giving a tablet of morphine or some other administration that could take up to an hour to become effective if you swallow it, the idea is that you would use sublingual sufentanil and get immediate relief for these really painful situations, like, you know, obviously an IED or something, you know, somebody loses a limb on the battlefield and they need immediate relief. For that reason, I think that the proponents of this passing FDA approval think that it's a really important thing, that it fills a niche, it fills a void. But I've also seen counter arguments from people that say there already are sublingual opioids available that are already quite strong. The strength of this is not sufficient enough for it to be, you know, offering something new that individuals don't already have access to, but the potential for abuse and the risk involved in that could actually outweigh the positive benefits. And so,
but don't you find those two arguments contradictory? So they're saying on the one hand, it's nothing new, but it presents a new threat.
I think it's contradictory in the sense that it's opening the floodgates further as opposed to moving in the other direction. So in my mind, that's not necessarily contradictory. If you're looking at somebody who works as an activist or an advocate who is trying to reduce the amount of opioids available in the street, they're going to be actively trying to reduce. And they actually did get a recently approved opioid repealed. I don't know if that's the right word, but taken back off the market. And so I think their reasoning is not, oh, there already are some, this is one more. It's like, no, we can't even just have one more because that makes the
yeah. Well, I disagree with that argument.
Which is fair.
But it doesn't address what I was saying, is that they're saying it's not a novel drug. It doesn't fit any unfilled niche,
which
right?
is funny because the drug company says it is.
The drug company says it does, but they can't say that it presents a unique threat and it's not unique at the same time.
I know. So basically, yeah, the drug companies are saying this is unique. There's a unique need. We need it. And then the proponents are saying, no, it's not unique. We don't need it. Yeah, the opponents. I'm sorry. But the main conversation, real quick, just one more little tidbit, is that the biggest argument that a lot of people have had so far, in addition or in which is compatible with this argument against potential for abuse, is that the chair of the FDA Advisory Committee on Analgesics and Anesthetic Drug Products, Dr. Rayford Brown, was apparently not present on the October 12th vote where the committee voted in favor of the FDA approving the drug. And that person, Dr. Rayford Brown, is actively voicing that he is very disappointed by the decision and he doesn't want it to stand. So there's somebody within the FDA who is on the advisory committee on pain medication who is not comfortable with this decision. So that's where a lot of the strife seems to be coming in.
Yeah, I mean, and it's happening at a point in time when there is an opioid crisis, and so there's a lot of pushback against opioids. But this is one of those things that sort of waxes and wanes over the years.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, opioids are a double-edged sword. They're very effective pain medication, but they're very addictive. And so they have to be used extremely carefully. I'm mainly, in my own practice, taking people off of them, and I never initiate them or almost never initiate them just because the kind of things that I treat, the opioids are not the right medications for it. But
and so this drug specifically is not even meant for a
I would never
like
use
yourself.
It. I would never. So this is for trauma basically, or and this, which could be, you know, car accident or whatever, like an emergency
somebody
room kind of trauma,
or
battlefield.
And they need immediate relief of the pain so that they can stop screaming, so that the people, you know, the ER docs don't have to put them into a medically induced coma just to work on them.
So it's a risk versus benefit assessment, right?
Yeah.
So is the potential benefit of having this other formulation enough to justify the whatever increased risk it poses? I think the potency argument is misunderstood a lot, which is why I wanted to be sure we were using the right term.
Absolutely. And that's, of course, the headline of every write-up.
Yeah, it's a thousand times more powerful. It's irrelevant. It's entirely irrelevant. You may, and it may seem odd that potency is entirely irrelevant, but it is, because
it's only irrelevant insofar as it's not, like we said, stronger if you take. But the difference here is that people might not know how to dose it. They might be like,
yeah, but they're not going to be dosing
it. Two.
They're not going to be. Here's the thing. There's no ceiling effect for opiates, meaning there's no limit on how much of an effect you can get. So if you take 1,000 times the morphine, it's the same as, right?
No, well, the ceiling effect is that you die.
Well, I know that, but I'm saying, but it's all, and this is dosed in micrograms.
Yes, this is right? 30, I think okay. It's a 15 microgram, 30. And a 30 microgram pill.
Yeah, right. So 30 micrograms has the same effect as 30 milligrams of morphine. So who cares? It's a pill. I think the real question is the formulation that it's available in itself, what's the abuse potential there? And the second is how available is it going to be?
Yeah, and it's not going to be available at all.
It's not going to be available at all. So I think it's going to be safer than drugs that you can get a prescription for.
That's the hope. It has a black box warning, right?
I think the legitimate concern is that because it's sublingual, it's more rapidly absorbed, and that has more abuse potential.
Mm-hmm.
So the formulation,
by it faster.
Yeah, and you don't have to inject.
I know it's tough, right? From a medical perspective, it's necessary and it's important and it's regulated and everything seems to be on the up and up. And I don't think that patients in hospital are going to be worse for wear from this. I think they're going to be better off. I don't think patients on the battlefield are going to be worse for wear. I think they'll be better off. But then the question is, what about all of the people who potentially could get their hands on it outside of that?
All right, Jay, before we do Who's That Noisy, we have a couple of quick updates for our patrons. First, the next patron live streaming episode that we're going to be doing is Monday, November 12th. That's just in 5 days from the time we're recording this, a couple days after this comes out, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, because we just... You know, daylight savings time just ended. And we've gotten a lot of questions from our higher level patrons. They're saying basically, where's my signed book that I was promised? Well, your book is in the mail. They have been, Jay has mailed them all out, right, Jay?
As of when you hear this, they will have been mailed, yes.
Nice.
Mm. Nice use of the future perfect? Or
yes.
They will have been mailed.
Yeah, they will have been mailed.
The future is now.
Yeah, and if you're interested in becoming a patron and supporting the work that we do,
please,
you can go to patreon.com/skepticsguide.
All right, Jay, give us a Who's That Noisy. Do you even remember? What was the last one that we did?
Do I remember? I am Who's That Noisy at this point, correct?
Dr. Mm-hmm. Noisy.
So last week, I played this noisy. So what was that? I had a ton of emails because I hadn't been, you know, manning Who's That Noisy for weeks at this point. So Ella Ingram sent us an email. She said, hi there, love SGU. The most recent noisy sounds like a lot of long arm sewing machine, like a long arm sewing machine operating via a computerized module. Definitely mechanical. Cool guess. I did look up what a long arm sewing machine is. It's a sewing machine.
Ella, with a long
you.
Arm.
Yes. Thank you for sending that in, but that's not correct. Gary Henderson wrote in, I was reading an article online when the noisy was played and I thought, hey, it's worth a guess. Is that the sound of a $1.4 million Banksy painting shredding itself after being auctioned? Remember that?
Yes, I remember.
The self-shredding
painting. I definitely remember that.
Yeah. Yes. So,
yeah. You didn't see that? It was amazing.
It's modern art.
So what a stunt. This guy became a very famous street artist. And, really hit it big. And one of his pieces was auctioned. And right when the auction concluded, when it was formally owned, not by the auction house, but owned by the buyer, I believe, right? Because the auction had ended.
Yeah, they had already they had already bid on it. And that had approved.
It then self-shredded itself inside of its frame.
Yeah, it was supposed to finish shredding, but it only got halfway and then got like stuck.
Yeah, I guess they're trying to figure out, is it worthless or is it worth even more? So that
it's
was
worth
funny.
Even more. That's the whole thing about Banksy, right? Is that like no matter what he does, people keep wanting to pay for it because he does that all that like anti-art stuff.
So I'm going to give the win to a listener named Paul DeBoer, B-O-E-R. And he said, was it a servo turning a ball screw? He says, not sure what is going on though. Okay, well, Paul, I think that you might be onto it. That's why I'm going to give you the win, because this was a very hard noisy. Now, the person who sent it in, Randy. Randy is a I'll give you a couple of hints. He's a builder. Randy likes to build things that move around and make noises. Randy likes to build things that make beeping sounds, maybe from a movie that you've heard in the past. Randy builds R2-D2 droids, or has built an R2-D2 droid.
It totally sounded like a droid.
And this is the head of the droid on its swivel. Randy, do me a favor. Email me in and tell me if it's a servo turning some type of ball screw, which I think it is. I think it is. I might be wrong, but I still want to give Paul the win because he was on to it. So here's my formal shout out to the R2 Builders Club. And Randy, thanks a lot. That was a really fun noisy. Tons of guesses. So many people were guessing all these different things. You know, I just was barely able to touch on some of them, but these were some of the most fun ones. So I have a new noisy for this week. This week, the noisy was sent in by a listener named Daniel Linseth. Saith, S-A with a umlaut above it, T-H. He's Swedish. Daniel Linseth.
Mm-hmm.
This one is awesome. Now, I'm going to play this. And look, we all know it's an animal. It's an animal. You need to identify the animal. There's lots of different noises that this particular animal makes. So take a listen to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Scared.
I love the variety of its vocalizations. Very cool. So get me, send me your guesses. You know, again, it's an animal. Just what is it? What kind of animal is it? Take some guesses. I'd love to hear what you guys think. I'll tell you right now, I listened to this. I was trying very hard not to reveal to myself what it was, because I like to play the game a little bit myself. And I'm telling you that I had no idea. Couldn't even come close. Very, very cool. So if you have any idea what this might be, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. That one was pretty cool. Let's see. We might have time for a couple of questions this week. The first one comes from San Jose, California. Scott Max is his NIM.
Yeah.
And Scott Max says, howdy, fellow skeptics. In episode 695, you mentioned the collapse of the Tacoma Narrows Bridge and recommended listeners look up the footage on YouTube. I did so, and the first thing I noticed is that the bridge is only two lanes wide, so adding a quote-unquote couple of lanes to the original design couldn't have led to the collapse. I kept digging and found a couple sources that posit an alternate cause for the bridge's demise. The bridge collapsed due to aeroelastic flutter. Aeroelastic flutter is a separate phenomenon from forced resonance. The YouTube channel Practical Engineering has a great video on the subject, Why the Tacoma Narrows Bridge Collapsed. I got a bunch of emails about this, and I did look into it a lot deeper. So this is one of those things where I didn't prep this. It was just sort of an off-the-cuff comment that I was going based upon, you know, what I had previously learned about the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. So to recap, this was...
I hate when we do that.
I know it's hard. That's the risk of unscripted. And it's, again, it was a live show. Usually I'll look it up. You know, if something comes up, I'll just sort of look it up in real time. That's, again, the risk is elevated when you're doing a live like stage show like that. But in any case, the Tacoma Narrows Bridge collapsed on November 7th. So today, actually, in 1940.
Wow.
By coincidence. What are the odds? And
1 million.
It turns out it's a famous example in physics textbooks, which is where I first learned about it. Right. And the textbooks get it wrong. So I was actually taught wrong about it, and I was just perpetuating that incorrect science textbook fallacy. So it's often presented as a case of forced resonance. You have resonance in different types of motion, like up and down versus torsional, and then that magnifies and, you know, increases the energy until it collapsed. Turns out the actual physics are a lot more complicated than that. So although there is some resonance going on, resonance is happening in the complicated physics of what happened to the bridge. And there also was a redesign. So I was wrong about what the redesign was, but there was a redesign at one point. But the redesign was for saving money. The original design would have cost $11 million. And they said, hey, we're just going to replace these trusses with these plate girders, and that will drop the cost down to $8 million. And they didn't anticipate or try to figure out how that was going to affect the physics of the bridge. So what happened was, from the day the bridge was completed and people were using it, it was a bouncy bridge, right? Even a moderate wind would get the thing, you know, moving up and down. But you got a higher wind day, like a 50 mile per hour wind day, and this aeroelastic flutter took over. And that was essentially the wind blowing across the bridge. Now, normally bridges have the trusses so that they're essentially there's a hollow place for the wind to go through the bridge. But the solid girders block the wind, and therefore a lot more of that wind energy got translated into the movement in the bridge itself. They also didn't make the bridge rigid enough, right? So you can fix this problem also by making it more rigid, by making it stronger, basically.
And then you can also crawl metal.
Yeah, and you can also have dampeners, things that will dampen any movement that gets going. So they didn't have any of these things. The girders caused the bridge to move. And then the bridge started twisting, right? You got like a torsional frequency going. Yeah. Once that happened, that's when the flutter started. Now, the flutter, what that does is this: the wind has to get separated. It blows like above and below the road, you know, part of the bridge. And then that causes a vortex underneath the bridge, which then increases the torsional, like, twisting of the bridge itself. And then you get to the point where the bridge will start, that the movement of the bridge becomes self-reinforcing. In other words, it no longer even needed the wind. That the movement of the bridge itself caused the flutter, which caused more twisting, which caused more flutter, which caused more twisting, runaway effect, and then that's when the bridge collapsed. So it is kind of a complicated thing, all the different phases. The real problem was that, so you should engineer bridges so that the wind speed at which one kind of movement occurs is very different than the wind speed at which the flutter occurs. But in the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, they were almost the same. So the effect was able to go right from one into the other. And that led to the collapse. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Nasty.
So now it's a test case, like the Tacoma Narrows Bridge. Like, don't build your bridge like this, right? You got to do... Don't make all the mistakes that were made. But what's also interesting, in addition to this being like an oversimplified to the point of being wrong example in physics textbooks, which is exactly how I first learned about it. In addition, when I was studying it, a lot of people were saying that a lot of this was known like 50 years before the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, when bridges were smaller, made out of different materials. The bridge builders learned all of this. But then they forgot, like it was lost. There was essentially a generational gap. And those hard-won lessons of the 19th century were forgotten, you know, by the middle of the 20th century. Then as new materials were being used to build bridges. And then the Tacoma Narrows was like the first modern bridge where this happened. And they had to relearn all of those lessons that had been previously learned. Mm.
They fell off the shoulders of giants.
Also, you know, no one died when this bridge collapsed, and the reason for that is when the bridge started to sway during that windy day, they closed the bridge. Like, they kind of knew that it was not safe.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that guy, Bob, that was on the bridge, that was a reporter who went there deliberately.
Really?
Yeah. So it wasn't somebody who just happened to get stuck there. Like, he knew the bridge was closed, and he went there anyway. But yeah, the video is amazing. The video of the bridge is absolutely amazing.
If that were me, I mean, I would be running off that bridge screaming.
Yeah.
All right. But thanks to everyone who wrote in about that. That's the stories are always more complicated than you think. But it is disappointing how so many science textbooks get things wrong. Yeah. And that's not an isolated example. There's a lot of examples. And also how they get repeated so many times. It's not like one physics textbooks. It becomes like the standard example in many physics textbooks. Okay, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Guess what the theme is this week?
Thanksgiving.
No. I know you're hopeful, Jay. You're hopeful.
I know, right?
Antimatter.
The solar system.
Theme is engineering failures, inspired by the Tacoma Narrows Bridge item. Wow. These are other epic engineering failures.
Nice.
Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Bob is.
All right. This is fun. It's fun and it's tragic. It's horrible, but it's terrible. But terrible, awful, but fun. Okay. Here we go. Item number one. In 1928, the St. Francis Dam near Los Angeles experienced sudden catastrophic failure just 12 hours after its final inspection, resulting in over 400 deaths. Item number two, in 1971, the 40-story Hyatt Regency Hotel in Kansas City experienced total failure and collapse during a magnitude 4.2 earthquake because it was not designed to existing standards, resulting in over 600 deaths. And item number three, in 1984, a safety valve in a chemical plant in Bhopal, India, released 40 tons of methyl isocyanate, a toxic gas, into the air, immediately killing 3,000 nearby residents and ultimately being blamed for 15,000 to 20,000 premature deaths and over 600,000 injuries. It's a brand new day, so anybody can go first here. So, Kara, go first.
Yeah, I mean, it makes no difference. I have no – this is just literally a shot in the dark. So you did them in order of the year, which is interesting.
And deadliness.
And deadliness, which is interesting. You would think that would be inverse. But 1928, St. Francis Dam near Los Angeles, sudden catastrophic failure just 12 hours after its final inspection. That's interesting. There's like no water in LA. Like maybe in 28 there was 400 deaths. St. Francis Dam near LA. I've literally never heard of this. 71, the 40-story Hyatt Regency Hotel in Kansas City. Okay. Total failure, collapse during a magnitude 4.2 earthquake, not designed to existing standards. 4.2 is so low magnitude. But if it was like on a fault right underneath Kansas, like right underneath the hotel, 4.2 could still do a lot of damage. Although, is Kansas City on a fault? Were people fracking in 1971? I don't know. 84, safety valve in a chemical plant in Bhopal, India, released 40 tons. I like how they're tons.
It's actually T-O-N-N-E-S is different than T-O-N-S. It's just a
Oh, is it? I always thought it was just like the British.
No, but they're actually different. They're actually different.
Different thing.
But they're similar. They're very similar. Yeah,
okay. Close. It's like not different enough to make any effect.
It's like a meter and a yard. You know, they're like roughly the same. Yeah,
Methyl isocyanate, toxic gas into the air, immediately killing 3,000 and ultimately being blamed for 15,000 to 20,000 premature. Jesus, and 600,000 injuries in 84. All this happened. 84 was the year after I was born, so I would not have like seen any of this. Yeah, I was alive. I would not have noticed this in the news, though, right. And nor would I have noticed the Kansas City. None of these register as big failures that are in my consciousness.
That's why I chose them.
Okay, so let me just, I'm just going to try and pick out what could be weird. So 4.2 earthquake causing an entire hotel to collapse, unlikely simply because, you know, I feel those, or I don't even feel it when an LA has 4.2 earthquakes. Like it doesn't even, I don't notice they're happening under my feet. That said, like I said, if it happened directly underneath, like the fault was directly underneath, of course it could do damage. LA doesn't have water. So, I mean, I'm sure we have dams and it says near LA, but I think we get our water from pretty far away from LA and bring it in. So that one seems kind of weird to me. 12 hours after its final inspection. How sad. And then the chemical plant in Bhopal, methyl isocyanate. I mean, if it's anything like cyanide gas, that could be really dangerous. It could definitely kill people within the nearby area. I have no idea on this one. So I'm just going to shot in the dark it and say that the Kansas City one is the fiction, because maybe it would have had to be a higher magnitude in order to do something like that. Maybe it happened somewhere else in the country and it was a higher magnitude.
Okay, Jay.
This one, the St. Francis Dam, had a catastrophic failure 12 hours after its final inspection. You know, I see no reason to not believe this one. The part of it that I don't like is that it's hours after its final inspection. I want to know what happened to whoever that person was. I always like that human story, you know, like, okay, so the thing collapsed, there's an inspector, and hours later, you know, hey, didn't you inspect that bridge? You know, like what was that conversation like?
Oh, no, that wasn't me. That was...
wrong Joe.
I left something in my car.
in my buggy.
Maybe that person, like, forever... Whenever you talk to that person, they just go, oh,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's right, how people talk back then.
1971, there's a 40-story Hyatt Regency Hotel, Kansas City, and they experienced a total failure and collapse during a magnitude 4.2 earthquake. 600 deaths. Well, that means that the entire building went down, if I'm reading that correctly. 40 stories, 600 people. Jesus. That's kind of terrible. In 1971. Now, I don't remember hearing about that, you know, just a earthquake taking it down. Okay, last one here, 84, safety. In 1984, the safety valve, whoa, in Bhopal, India, whoa. Yeah, I think this one is science. This one happened. All these people, God, could you imagine? And what happened to the inspectors there? This is terrible. Okay, so I'm just going to say that this thing with the Hyatt Regency is the fake.
Okay, Evan.
Yeah, I'm looking at this one as well. Kansas City. It's on a river. So would that have had anything to do with it? Because I'm trying to think the fault lines there. Is there a fault line there? 4.2 earthquake. We hear about earthquakes in the Midwest these days, but mostly we talk about them in the context of fracking and those sorts of things. So in the pre-fracking days, were there these sorts of earthquakes occurring in this region of the country? Probably. It is kind of a relatively low magnitude earthquake, but maybe not for the region. Jeez, was not designed to existing standards in 1971. I can see a 1928 thing not, you know, cutting the mustard, but a 1971 hotel, you know, it's not like they didn't have codes and things then. That would be really surprising. So I think I'm leaning towards that one as the fiction as well. And, you know, just really sad about Los Angeles and many times more sad about Bhopal, India. So I'll go with the group. I'll say it's the Hyatt Regency in Kansas City is the fiction.
All right. And Bob.
1928. I mean, was there even science back then? I mean, that just doesn't even surprise me.
What? Of course there was.
I mean, 12 hours is pretty tragic and hilarious at the same time. 400 deaths, of course, it really sucks. But so that one actually seems the most plausible. Jump into to the third one, the Bhopal. I remember Bhopal. I remember that whole thing.
Bhopal, not RuPaul.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Thanks, Jay. So I remember that. I mean, it's 84. Wasn't, you know? Yeah, it was a long time ago. Jesus. But I still I still remember it. The details, of course, escape me. Like the name of the dam. The chemical, I mean, I don't remember. I just remember it was nasty. So that could be changed. The number of deaths is kind of ringing a bell. That sounds about right, 3,000. But the other numbers, I have no idea in terms of the premature deaths. It's huge, 15,000 to 20,000. That's gargantuan. Over 600,000 injuries. I mean, those numbers could be way, way inflated by orders of magnitude. But I'm still going to kind of go with that one since it's mostly true. And the big problem I have with the Hyatt Regency one, the second one, is 4.2 earthquake. You know, it's a logarithmic scale. I mean, that's kind of weak. And even 71 wasn't that long ago. They knew what they were doing to a certain extent, even though they might not have had the best earthquake rules in play in the building code. But it's 4.2. I mean, that's not a lot. 40-story building. So yeah, that one just rubbed me the wrong way. That just seems too low. So I'll just run with that and say that that's fiction, like everyone.
All
else.
Right. So you guys all agree. So let's
no way.
Let's take these in order. Yeah. Take this. We'll start with the first one. In 1928, the St. Francis Dam near Los Angeles experienced sudden catastrophic failure just 12 hours after its final inspection, resulting in over 400 deaths. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Cool.
So that was
sort of.
That was bad. So Jay, William Mulholland was
Mulholland.
William Mulholland was the engineer who designed the bridge, the dam. Mm.
He inspected it as well.
And he also inspected it.
Oh, yeah. That is so crazy because Mulholland's name is all over LA. Like, yeah. They love him.
It was the Mulholland Dam, but it was also the in his honor, but it was also the St. Francis Dam.
So I knew that one.
So this guy was a self-taught engineer. You believe that? He didn't have a formal degree. He was self-taught. I guess he just picked it up. And he just totally screwed up. He used the wrong kind of dam, basically. And he also added 20 feet to the height of the dam during its planning without making adjustments for it. Like, he didn't make it thicker. He just said, okay, yeah, we could throw 20 feet on there, no problem.
Mm.
He didn't really, properly adapt the dam to the site itself, right? So just multiple engineering failures. Also, the dam was a little leaky. And they just sort of said, dams leak, what are you going to do?
Leaky dam. Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
And literally, he gave it his blessing. This dam is approved. And 12 hours later, I think it was the left bankment just collapsed. And then once one thing goes, the whole structure, then it's like that cascade of effects. And there's the whole thing went. And a tower of water just flooded the valley, killing 400 people.
Jeez.
Sad.
Wow. Yeah.
So sad. Awful.
That's because they didn't want to use one of them egg-headed engineers, with an actual degree, because that would be elitist.
Wait, so why do people in L.A. love this Mulholland guy so much? Because his name is literally on everything.
I don't know. So to his credit, in the hearing afterwards, trying to figure out what was going on, he said, "Don't blame anyone else. You can just fasten it on me. If there was human error, I was the human." So he took full credit for it, which he should have, because it was 100% his failure. And he retired. Of course he's going to retire. No one's going to let you build a friggin' doorknob after that. You kill 400 people because you screw up. Yeah, you're done.
Yeah.
Sorry, your career is over. So
now, why couldn't they hold him accountable?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that would be a lawsuit, right, in modern
times?
But
also, I don't know, how often did structural things happen like that in the 20s?
Yeah.
The standards were probably pretty different. It was I don't know, he thinks it's going to hold. Nobody here knows any better.
Yeah, but who hired him? That's an important question.
I know.
What, you do this in your backyard in your spare time?
The Los Angeles Bureau of Waterworks and Supply.
Wow.
Yeah, the dam was 40 miles northwest of Los Angeles, Kara.
Okay.
That's part of the Los Angeles aqueduct system.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, I don't know what building standards were like in 28, just in general.
But apparently he failed even to the standards of his time.
Yeah, exactly.
He just didn't do it right.
Yep.
Let's go to number two. In 1971, the 40-story Hyatt Regency Hotel in Kansas City experienced total failure and collapse during a magnitude 4.2 earthquake because it was not designed to existing standards, resulting in over 600 deaths. You guys all think this one is the fiction. So none of you have heard of the Hyatt Regency Hotel disaster of 1971.
Crap.
Wasn't that a fire?
This was a shot in the dark for me, and you guys all followed suit. So I'm going to blame you, not me, on this one.
Throwing everyone under the bus there, right back there.
Wow.
But this one
picked it regardless of
is the fiction. This is the fiction.
It is.
So it was the Hyatt Regency walkway collapse in 1971, killed 114 people. Injured 216 more. And again, it was a situation where they just sort of rigged something up without really doing the math, you know, without doing the engineering.
Jeez.
And they didn't do the calculations. They had these two walkways. You know, like you have hotels with an open courtyard in the middle, you know, and they had walkways like stories up. And
oh, like a catwalk.
They
like
were suspended. Yeah, they were suspended. Ooh. And they had to move them around for some reason. They had them both hanging from the same structure, which could not hold the weight. And so they both collapsed, fell down to the lobby, killing 114 people.
Oh my God, that's horrible.
Yeah, just a total engineering failure. They didn't do the due diligence. They didn't like do the calculations. Yeah.
Amazing.
Oh my gosh.
It pales in comparison to the final one. In 1984, yep. A safety valve in a chemical plant in Bhopal, India, released 40 tons of methyl isocyanate, a toxic gas, into the air, immediately killing 3,000 nearby residents and ultimately being blamed for 15 to 20,000 premature deaths and over 60,000 injuries is, unfortunately, science. You guys remember the company?
Yep. Union Carbide here in Connecticut.
Union Carbide in Danbury, Connecticut.
It? Oh, yeah. It's the Connecticut connection to this. Yeah. I knew this one.
Yeah, we all knew about it because it was in Danbury. We knew people who worked for Union Carbide.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a plant in India, in Bhopal, India, and it was really all the local management that is to blame, although I guess they didn't have the proper oversight from headquarters. You know, this was, again, multiple layers of failure. Oh, yeah. I mean, just reading the summary of all the things they did wrong, it's huge. So, like, they were just ignoring warning bells. They were... Yeah, you know, like there was a leak. They're like, sometimes we fix the leaks, sometimes we don't.
They didn't have
a computer system, which existed at the time, to like monitor all the systems. And do you know what their leak warning system was?
A whistle.
What?
No.
Some guy with a hat and a flashing light.
A red flag.
Oh, was it a canary? Wow. It was a canary.
Bob's close. It was basically if their eyes started to water, that was a sign that the chemical was leaking because this is like tear gas.
Oh my God.
So it was just the physical symptoms. That was their early warning system. So they essentially what happened is too much water got in the tank and that caused an exothermic reaction, which raised the temperature in the tank, which then caused problems. But then they had a safety tank that was supposed to be empty, but it was full. So they couldn't offload into the safety tank. And then it just sort of auto-vented to the outside, which was not supposed to happen either. And then, unfortunately, this gas is heavier than air, so it just sort of crept over the land and
creeping
just sort of moved through.
Up.
Yeah,
and just mowed people down, man.
Bodies strewn all over the fields. It was horrid.
Ugh.
It was the place where it was not zoned for a plant like that. It was zoned for light industry, but this was a toxic chemical plant, and it was in the wrong location. There was like a shanty town around it, killed everybody in the area.
So it went about how was this even
like? How did all these things happen at once?
I know people were improperly trained. They didn't have any. They didn't have a public warning system in place. They had buses. They had buses that were there to evacuate people if they had a leak, but the employees. Jay, they ran out with their hands above their head screaming and left the buses behind. And they left the people behind to be killed.
Oh my gosh.
Wow, that's terrible.
Because they didn't know what they were doing. They just were not trained. They just, you know, all the protocols were being violated. It was just horrible. And they were manufacturing this horribly toxic gas that if it got out would kill people, you know? Complete negligence. And there was a huge lawsuit. This cost the company over $500 million. Yeah, it was just.
And it probably should have been
$500 million. Doesn't feel big.
It doesn't cut it, right? It doesn't cut it.
84, maybe it seemed a little more, but you're right, Kara. It seems insignificant.
Just terrible.
Yeah.
But I remember hearing about this case when it happened, and of course, it was the Danbury connection wherever we live. So. Yeah, I was wondering if you guys. I didn't mention Union Carbide because you guys would have that totally would have triggered it if I mentioned that. You guys probably already still remembered it, but
totally remembered. Yeah, I mean it would have been a
giveaway. So I lowballed the 4.2. I was just pulling that out of my ass on the earthquake because I figured I was in a 3.4. So I'm like, I'll go about 10 times more powerful than that. And that's probably about right.
Yeah, you still
can't
really feel it.
But it really, I felt that 3.4.
Really,
well,
I would have
a building.
Yeah, yeah,
it doesn't matter. If you had said like six, I might have started all to right. believe it. I can't feel anything from below earthquakes. Like 5.5.
You're so desensitized to earthquakes.
Yeah. No, I don't have shake sense. I've always said this. Like there have been so many times other people will feel things that
I
won't.
Kara, if you join Scientology and you get to the right level, you can get shake sense as one of your superpowers.
Oh.
No way.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
God, do you guys remember that?
Sense hunger was my favorite one.
Sense hunger.
Isn't that like redundant? Hunger is a sense.
Feel objects.
Feel touch. Okay.
Smells.
Yeah, smell,
taste flavor.
Smell. Yeah, taste flavor.
Oh man.
All right.
So good.
Good job, guys. I gotta make this harder. I'm just going too easy on you, clearly.
Clearly.
Yeah, I don't think so.
All right. Well, good job, everyone.
Thank you.
Evan, give us a quote.
I much prefer the sharpest criticism of a single intelligent man to the thoughtless approval of the great masses. Written by Johannes Kepler. And I happened across this quote as I was doing some research for my topic on the Kepler telescope.
Yeah. Kepler is awesome.
Oh, yeah. He was great.
Kepler's three laws.
Laws of planetary motions.
You know what they are. Right, Kara?
Do I know what they are?
Yeah.
No. Spinny, biggie. Not falling.
The three laws of planetary motion.
Planets go around suns and ellipses.
With the sun at one focus.
Sweep out equal time. Equal time and speed. Right.
That was a cool one. That's my favorite one.
And the last one's a bit weird. Has to do with the inverse something of something else. I don't have it up.
That's the ratio of the distance and their period, orbital period.
Yeah, spinny, like I said.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Thank you guys for joining me this week. Jay, is there anything else to announce, or did we cover everything in the middle of the show?
I think we're good.
Yeah. I think we're good. So thank you, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.